Are we doing it?
Yeah, I was going to attempt to...
Is it happening?
Yeah.
We're recording already.
Yes.
Why don't you tell me before that happens? Why don't you say, okay, Dave, in 3, 2, 1, or something.
Usually...
Why don't I participate in a professional podcast? What is your problem?
Usually I do. I was going to try and sneak some music in there, but
Oh, you were going to be ambitious finally with music again?
Well, I was going to give it a shot.
You were going to try to do your job and give us a music bed intro?
We don't need a music bed intro.
We do.
No, we don't.
We need awesome music select.
Hell no. The Comedy Couch doesn't have music, so we don't have to have music either.
We're not a comedy couch.
Doesn't matter.
They need something more.
Proven that you can
have comedy. We don't have much of anything.
Nonetheless, we're making it work. This is the Linoleum Knife Podcast.
And Alonzo Duraldi is that guy talking who's not doing anything right right now, other than being a film critic for What the Flick. That is
on the Young Turks Network.
On the Young Turks Network, available to be seen for free on YouTube.
Yes.
Where he is the rotating, you're the rotating fourth.
Right.
That's basically your title. Mm-hmm. It's a three-person hosted show, and then when one of them has a mild cough, or a play date for their infant, or has to fly to Atlanta to co-host segments on TCM.
Or just hasn't seen the movie.
Then you get to be on What the Flick.
Right. And I'm okay with that.
No, it's okay to be the rotating fourth. You're one of them.
Yes.
You're one of the four.
I am indeed.
Yeah. They don't have a rotating fifth, do they?
Not that I know of.
Right. Because you're always free.
Pretty much. I try to make myself available, is what you mean.
Always free.
And the ingrate across the table from me, who's talking bollocks, is Dave White, film critic for movies.com and drinker of tea.
Which is what I'm doing right now.
Yes. I was going to try and throw in that song, California.
Which one?
The one from
If Ever I See You Again. Oh, my God. All right. First of all.
In honor of the late Joe Brooks, who was a mess.
Is there any way, can you say in honor of him? This guy's life.
Okay, maybe not honor is not the right word. But
like if they had pamphlets in the high school guidance counselor's office on how not to destroy your own life. It would be like, don't do the things that this guy did, and then don't do them in succession.
Right.
You know, like if you did one of them, for example, if you were simply the writer of and director of bad movies.
Right.
That would be, maybe you could even be beloved
you did that. If people haven't picked up on this, we're talking about Joseph Brooks, who passed away
we need to
recently.
Backtrack. So explain everything.
Okay, Joseph Brooks was a very successful writer of commercial jingles.
Do you know what jingles he wrote?
He wrote You've Got a Lot to Live and Pepsi's Got a Lot to
really?
Live.
Oh, really? He wrote that?
Among others.
If you're old, you know what that song is. If you're young,
you don't care.
Anyway,
and then...
Nor do you have to care.
He wrote and directed You Light Up My Life, which was not a big movie, but the song was huge, and...
it was more than huge.
It was the inescapable earworm of 1977.
It was My Heart Will Go On of 1977.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it won him an Academy Award and a Golden Globe for Best Original Song. So then, even though the movie didn't do that well because the song was such a hit...
It was the Boom Boom Pow of 1977.
Because the movie was such a hit, he got to make another film, and he decided this time not only would he write and direct it, but he would star in it as well. And that was If Ever I See You Again, where he plays a writer of commercial jingles who has aspirations to make more serious music and decides to try and reconnect with an old flame played by Shelley Hack.
Now, If Ever I See You Again is basically unavailable.
Yeah, it was
on any format. Am I right about that?
It was released on VHS, actually.
Oh, was it?
Yes, but never on DVD. It does pop up on cable every so often, which is how
we saw it.
And
we have a VHS copy.
Oh, yeah.
That we taped off of. Why we have it? Like,
because you can't get it.
But here's the thing. Okay, recently, we used to have this wall.
An entire wall,
and we had shelves built for this wall. And on this wall was Alonzo's archive. Not an archive.
Library.
Wad mess. dust collecting.
Oh, what? Just thing. Because they didn't have like Library of Congress numbers on them?
Seriously, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of VHS tapes.
That's how I roll.
And no, you don't.
Well, that's how I used to roll.
We took down those shelves because they were A, making me unable to breathe. In a very literal sense, because the dust was like inhabiting that room. It was also, oh, by the way, I forgot to mention this part, our bedroom. So,
and
so
people was, were always impressed when we gave them the house tour and they saw the wall. They weren't impressed.
They were freaked out. and so then, so we took the shelves down and we put them all in boxes
as part of Dave White's campaign to destroy my life.
But the thing is that recently I thought, he has to have access to this stuff. It can't just be in boxes. It can't just be haphazardly thrown into the very large closet.
Yes.
Now, we're lucky. We do have a big apartment with lots and lots of closet space. So they all did go into a closet. But then recently, we triaged those tapes and edited them down and got rid of a lot. They went into the recycling bin. And now they are organized.
The remaining ones.
The what's left is organized in a very thoughtful way in the closet for easy access, regardless of whatever it is you're looking for. One of the VHS tapes that Alonzo Duralde, because he had final say on everything that got kept, one of the tapes that made the cut to keep is If Ever I See You Again.
Yeah, because it's not available.
Why are you keeping it?
Well, because it's a terrible movie.
It is. It's okay, but there's a difference, right? There's, this is so terrible, I want to watch it 100 times. Mm-hmm. And then there's, this is so terrible, I've seen it, and now I never have to look at it again. If ever I see that movie again, it will be too soon.
Now that Joe Brooks has passed,
he didn't pass.
Okay,
he passed himself.
Okay, fine. Now that Joe Brooks has offed himself under allegations of terrible things,
tell the whole story. Keep talking.
Well, you read the big
article. I digressed about the VHS tapes. That you
anyway.
Tell
no,
the rest
I want to hang on to it because it's this thing.
I'm telling
you
to tell the rest of the Joe Brooks story.
I'm telling you to tell it because you read the big article about it and I didn't.
Okay, this dude, everything that he did was wrong. He apparently left behind zero amounts of friends.
No, anybody who ever worked with him. Like, the day after he died, we're giving quotes about how awful he was.
The day after he killed himself by putting his head into a plastic bag and tying it off.
Oh, that's how he did it? Oh.
Yeah. He suffocated himself with a plastic bag on his head. The day after he did this, there was an article about him in, it was the Los Angeles Times or the New York Times. I don't remember which one it was now.
I thought you read about it on Daily Beast.
Oh, it was the Daily Beast. It was the Daily Beast. Where they couldn't. The people were rushing to give quotes about this guy. Like, they dug up the guy who starred in You Light Up My Life, and I don't even remember this guy's name, but he was like, he was a horrible person. And his own children are quoted in this Daily Beast thing. They're adult children now. Well, I should say his adult daughter is quoted in this piece.
The son is a little inaccessible.
The son is inaccessible at the moment because he is in Rikers right now. Awaiting trial for the murder of his girlfriend. His daughter is quoted as defending. Brooks's daughter is quoted as defending the son who's on trial for murder by saying, "My father destroyed my brother and destroyed his own life." Like, and then they quote the madam of the brothel in New York. Her name is actually Kristen Davis, I think. Not the Sex and the City Kristen Davis, who basically comes right out in the Daily Beast piece and says, "I supplied him with a couple hundred girls over the course of a few years." And this is when he's like in his 60s, right? And he would want to play role-playing games, casting couch role-playing games with them, until finally he started complaining about the prostitutes that would get sent over to his house because he would say they weren't skinny enough and they weren't young enough.
Yeah.
And
got violent with them, right?
And would get violent with them until finally none of them would go to his house and fight. And then he got banned from ordering in
right
from this place. And so then he took an ad out on Craigslist, apparently, or took out a series of ads on Craigslist, basically pretending to be casting for a Broadway play or a movie or something,
mm-hmm.
so that unsuspecting young women would come to the house, and then he would allegedly rape them.
Pull the same shenanigans.
Yeah. And so he was up ready to go to trial for like 11, I think, counts.
There were quite a few.
Of rape, if not more. And so then he killed himself. And he left behind two terrible, terrible movies.
And that is why I kept If Ever I See You Again on VHS.
All right, but here's the thing.
Because
that
story is
fascinating.
Because somebody we know is going to have a morbid desire to see that film now.
All right, well, that story is fascinating. And if there's ever there is a book about that story, I'll probably read it. Because because the success is great and all, but failure and misery and suicide are interesting. And
especially when you've been successful.
You can't really learn from watching a successful person because they leave out all the details. They just go, and then one day I became rich and famous because I'm amazing. Like, that's basically how anybody who's rich and famous tells the story.
Right.
Someone finally realized how amazing I was, showered me with money,
right,
and put me on TV. But failure, you get to learn all the details. And you can actually learn things from failure, like how not to go do terrible things and be horrible to everybody, including your own children, and then start raping everyone.
And this guy also, he had like some one-man Broadway show that was apparently like...
Such a disaster
like that... closed before it opened.
Such a disaster that in the Daily Beast article, they compared it to the fake Springtime for Hitler musical from the producers.
Ouch.
Yeah.
So yeah, Joseph Brooks, no longer with us. How did we even start on this topic?
I don't know. California.
I was going to play that.
The song in If Ever I See You Again.
Besides the title track.
There is a title song that is sung by Joe Brooks. Yeah.
And he'll make you appreciate the vocal stylings of Burt Bacharach.
Yeah. But the song that was meant to be the hit single from the movie If Ever I See You Again is called California. It is sung by Debbie Boone.
Yes.
Just the same woman who sang...
Who had the hit with
You Light Up My Life.
Although she didn't sing it in the movie, as I recall.
And I have not heard a peep out of her.
Yeah.
She
and Didi Khan are not talking.
They're not talking to the press yet. Yeah. I've seen.
We'll have to Google
it. Yeah. But Didi Khan from Greece.
And who was the star of You Light Up My Life.
And who was the star of You Light Up My Life. Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Another terrible movie.
Yes.
Both two terrible movies.
Yeah. And he had something to do with some sort of London stage musical of the movie Metropolis, I remember.
I don't know anything about that.
I remember seeing posters for it when I spent like a day in London in like late 1988. And the fact that we've never heard about this show should probably tell you its success.
What are we talking about this week? Kung Fu Panda 2?
Yes, Hangover Rain. Part 2.
Tree of Life.
And
let's start with the Tree of Life.
Okay, sure.
Why
don't you describe it?
No. Why don't you describe it? Because you've become very good at describing this movie using my words. Go.
Okay, look, I was very upfront about this on when I posted. Here's what happened. I had to go review this film for What the Flick. And then that morning before I went over there, Dave read me the first part of his review, including the plot synopsis.
And then
I basically borrowed that plot synopsis when I did it on What the Flick. And I said so on Facebook when I posted the clip, because it's not an easy movie to synopsize. And also, I always tell Dave not to read me his reviews of things before I've done my review of
things. Because he's just going to steal them.
No, because I just don't want to, like...
You're going to walk around and spout off things and pretend
I don't want to have your verbiage in my head, you know. So you describe the plot.
No.
Because you're the one who did it originally. Wrong. It was all you. You created everything.
This
movie is about you because you created the universe.
Much like God in the Tree of Life. I did, in fact, create all of the words that came out of Alonzo Durazo's mouth.
Only the plot synopsis. My opinions are my own.
Sean Penn's having a midlife crisis. We don't know what kind of midlife crisis this is.
And he might be in Houston, and he might be in Dallas.
Might be in Houston. Everyone says that he's a Houston architect. And here's the thing about this: the movie itself. The movie never says, hello, my name is blah, blah, and I am a Houston architect. He's looking at some blueprints. Mm-hmm. So you're like, wow, well, that's what an architect would do. So he's, you know, apparently an architect. And then apparently he's also supposed to be in Houston, although in one prominently placed, you know.
He has got a very recognizable Dallas landmark.
Yeah. Like the
He's going up the elevator of Reunion Tower.
The most recognizable Dallas landmark that there is. The one that you see at the beginning of the show, Dallas.
In the skyline, the big round thing.
The big thing that looks like a
tickle roll-on.
Like a tickle roll-on. Yeah, that is the Reunion Tower with the ball on top.
Google that reference
It's in the movie. And then it's like, oh, he lives in Houston. Do they have one in Houston, too?
Yeah. It's a chain now.
Anyway, he flashes back to his childhood.
In Waco,
although it was shot outside of Austin. And Sean Penn is his dad, and Jessica Chastain.
No, Brad Pitt.
I mean, sorry. Brad Pitt is his father. Jessica Chastain is his mother. And you thought it was Bryce Dallas Howard for a minute.
Well, you know, she's a ginger.
They are. Yes, she is.
And she's a willowy ginger, the way that Bryce Dallas Howard is.
And he had basically an idyllic childhood that we get to see from a child's POV.
Yeah.
All these, like, this really great can-kicking moment.
Curtains billowing in the breeze. Yeah.
It's the touch, the feel of cotton. All these curtains flowing around in the breeze. Gorgeous, like, this lovely house, this beautiful neighborhood. This is very simple middle American life in the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, Two younger brothers.
Run and play, and they attach frogs to firecrackers and all the great things you do when you're a child. And you're tormenting nature's animals. And his mom is very loving and very indulgent and, you know, lets them jump on the furniture and stuff. But only when dad's not around, because dad is
stern,
old school.
Some critics have
you
called
don't
him
just call him father. You say yes, sir. Sir.
Some critics have called him abusive. Wrong. But I think that's stretching it.
No, there's no moment in the movie where he is abusive.
He is a Texas dad in the 1950s.
Right. He's stern. He's disciplinarian.
But loving.
He is strict. But he is definitely shown as being loving.
Yes.
And because because it's old school, he smacks the kids when they misbehave.
Yeah.
And
it was the 50s.
That's what people still do that, you know.
But they did a lot more in the 50s.
They did a heck of a lot more back then.
There wasn't a social stigma attached to it.
Right, and so then there's that, and then there's also the earth being formed.
Yes.
You see the earth being formed, and the lava flowing, and the microbes growing, and the things evolving, and the crust is cooling, and the macroorganisms and the microorganisms, they're all in very beautiful close-up detail. And then come the dinosaurs, and one of them steps on the other one's head, but then it sees it has done something wrong. And much like in The Land Before Time, these dinosaurs have feelings and mercy and empathy for one another.
Granted, the dinosaurs are on screen for like, 3 minutes?
Less than that.
Yeah. It's not a huge thing, but they're there.
You know, people talk about the dinosaurs, even though they have such very little screen time, because there are dinosaurs in this movie.
At all, yes.
Yeah, and so the thing is that I should back up and say that the movie also begins with a quote from the book of Job.
Oh, yes.
Where God is talking to Job. Job's been enduring a lot of God delivered trials.
Yes. And thanks.
And sort of, you know, crying out to God, why are you doing that? I will not disbelieve in you. I will always have faith in you, but why are you doing this to me?
But seriously.
And God's like, you don't know my life. That's basically what God says to Job.
Were you there when
I was creating the world, forming the earth?
Right.
That's the quote. Where were you when I was forming the earth? And
apparently Terrence Malick was there with a camera to get every last detail.
Here's the thing. I like this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't yet love this movie. I like it because it's got too much stuff going on in it, because it has too many ideas going on in it.
Which is a nice change, I will agree.
Because it's clearly incredibly personal.
Yeah.
And just because we don't always know what's happening or why.
It doesn't mean he didn't think about it.
It doesn't mean it's not thoughtful and intentional. Yeah. What it means is that I need to watch it 5 years from now again.
Yeah.
And I'm not one to really get too bunged up about the fact that sometimes if I'm watching a film that is structurally and formally different than, you know, the basic generic movies that we talk about week after week. I don't have to get every single thing right out. Like, I understand that if you are more than just a hack director, if you're an artist and you're making something that you feel is significant, you might be including your own hypocrisies and contradictions right there in the middle of the movie and putting them on display for people. So the fact that, you know,
there's an inconsistency.
There's some inconsistency in terms of how I understand the movie.
Right.
Doesn't mean that it doesn't all make perfect sense in Terrence Malick's mind.
Right.
And it's not his job to lay it all out for me and spell it out for me.
Mm-hmm.
If that were his job, I would never want to watch movies. I would not want to sit through anything again if I knew that every single movie that was coming my way
was being explained to
was
you.
Something I could predict or was being explained to me.
No, I agree.
So this is his ideas. These are his ideas about God and man and mercy and judgment and grace and order and chaos and, you know, beinghood and life, man. To that end, some of it is a little dorky. The wandering around on the beach, I think, is kind of hilarious.
Yeah, there's some stuff that's there is imagery in this movie that is as beautiful as anything as I've ever seen in a film. And there is imagery in this movie that is like BS, tired, trite, and corny. But
the sunflowers kind of annoyed me.
I think that this is a movie that people need to see, and they need to see in a theater.
Yeah, you really do not. Don't, if you can, like if you're living in a place where this movie is,
it'll get to you. It opened like on 4 screens this weekend, but it will get to you eventually.
But it might not get to you if you live in a small town.
Maybe not.
Like when I go to, you know, like I'm thinking again of Jennifer.
Uh-huh.
Jennifer, my good friend who lives in Hyco, Texas.
Right.
A town of 1,800 people.
Well, it may not come to Hyco, but it will come to Fort Worth.
They have to drive to Waco or Cleburne. To go to the movies.
Well, it will sometimes definitely. I'm sure it will screen in Waco.
It'll probably screen in Waco.
You know, set there.
It'll probably come to Waco, but maybe it might not. You know, but if you can
see it in a theater. Yeah, you know, and I mean, because I agree with you. It's a movie that's got its flaws, and maybe they're my flaws, and maybe they're his. Who knows? And I'm perfectly willing to say that I could be like the first audience of 2001 that was like, well, what were the cavemen doing there? Like, you know, this may be a movie that takes a while to sink in, or that I'm not going to understand right away. I mean, like, I remember leaving the screening and thinking about it all day and just thinking, well, for one thing, thank God I didn't have to, like, see it at the Cannes Film Festival and turn a review around within, like, the next hour. Because you really got to...
I want to know about those people at Cannes who immediately started booing.
Well, yeah.
Like... Like, you got it that quick.
Yeah, if anything, I would like you were ready. If you booed a day later, I would give you that. But, you know, on the spot, I was just too like, wait, what?
Come back tomorrow.
And then boo.
And then we'll have the special time for you to boo or cheer if you would like. Right.
So, yeah, it's a lot of things, and it's complicated, and it's challenging. And whether or not it all works... It's a movie you should totally see if you care about movies, if you like to think about movies, if you are not just looking to be entertained, but also to be, you know, moved really by what cinema can do. You know, it's an amazing experience.
I like how everybody in the movie,
the narration,
talks like this.
What do you want from me, God?
Follow me.
My original joke was that it's a movie about daddy issues where one of the daddies happens to be God.
Right.
That
sure was a joke.
The child.
Wasn't it?
Thank you.
Wasn't that a great joke that you made?
I'm funnier than you. The childhood stuff I thought was exquisitely done, like really filmed in a... I love movies that are from a child's point of view. Like when Spike Lee makes Crooklyn or you know...
Mac and Me.
I mean, like...
That's what I'm talking about. Like,
no, I'm not talking about Mac and Me. I'm talking about memoir movies. Like Crooklyn or Amarcord, Fanny and Alexander, where directors really kind of like, you know, you see things...
Sleepaway Camp.
I'm not going to have this conversation. From a child's perspective, I'm not going to have this conversation with you. You're not going to take this seriously.
I'm totally taking it seriously.
So anyway,
I'm talking about films that are from the perspective of a young person.
I'm going to punch you. It's very evocative of a child's point of view, and it's really beautifully shot. And frankly, if he had just made the movie of the childhood in Waco stuff with no Sean Penn and no dinosaurs, I think it would be a movie that everybody would immediately agree on was extraordinary.
But it would have been a step back for him.
But yeah, no, but it wouldn't have been the sort of ambitious.
Because this is definitely the kind of movie you were expecting from him after The New World.
Right. I'm just saying that would have been the safe choice. That would have been the movie that everyone would like, oh, yes, it's beautiful. We love it. Da, da, da. This movie is definitely dividing people, right. You know, and there are people, I think, you know, Matt Seitz.
People who are actually undergoing mitosis right now.
Exactly. But there are people out there who will love whatever it is that Terrence Malick does, no questions asked. And I run hot and cold with him, but I'm at least, you know, warm on this one. I liked it way better than The Thin Red Line, which did nothing for me. But I think
The Thin Red Line is really great.
I'm sure you do. You're one of those people. But like, I think, you know, Days of Heaven and Badlands are you know, great, great movies.
Badlands is my very favorite.
Really?
Yes. Okay. That is my very favorite Terrence Malick.
All right, moving on.
You don't care to hear about any reasons why or anything. You just want to keep the show moving, don't you?
You are Mr. You can't run too long. I don't want to pick up people's too much time on the.
I want to know that you're.
No. You want the show to be about the sound of your own voice.
You douse my fire all the time. No. Let's talk about Kung Fu Panda.
Tell us why you love Batman. Tell us why
this is about a killing spree.
Of course. Why did I even ask? Really? I already knew the answer to that one. Kung Fu Panda 2.
Also about a killing spree.
Sort of. Bloodless. I really enjoyed this film, and I also sort of admired the fact that they kind of didn't just rehash the first movie. Like, they sort of made an effort, I think, to go a little bit deeper. Like try and give us a little bit of characterization and a little bit of... You know, a little more plot, but not in such a way that it strayed too far from the sort of wacky hijinks of the first movie. So, you know, I like that. I think it was they got a little more ambitious, but they remained true to what the first one was. And I think I like it better than the first one, actually.
I'm just really happy to see movies where there's at least one character who's super committed to eating.
Okay.
Because I like to see myself represented on screen.
Uh-huh.
That's all.
Okay.
Yes. Eating and Kung Fu. I'm kind of, if you could just like, if there was a movie, if there was a regular annual film, at least just one a year, mm-hmm. about
a fat animal doing Kung Fu.
It doesn't have to be an animal. It'd be a big fat person.
Okay.
Just someone who really enjoys, you know, ribs and kicking people in the ribs.
Well, you know, there's all those old Sammo Hung movies.
Right. Those are great.
Yes.
That's all I have to say about Kung Fu Panda. That's all you have to say about
Kung Fu Panda 2.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was fun. I really liked it. It's a great sequel. It's good for kids. It's just scary enough for kids to be scared in the way that kids really do need to be scared.
Yes. It's visually inventive, I thought.
It's great to look at. It's got all this great martial arts stuff in it, even though it's animated. The 3D did not annoy me.
Nope.
And I'm about 80% cold on 3D these days. I mean,
really?
I'm not a hater of 3D, but I'm a hater of
lazy 3D.
Lazy 3D. I also do hate that people who do what we do for a living are the only ones who are coerced into watching 3D films. Y'all have a choice. Well, we do not have that
choice.
Okay,
see, now you are the one who is stealing.
What are you talking about?
That's something that Luke Thompson gave me as a quote for my upcoming MSNBC.com piece. I wonder
where that popped into my head
about 3D.
From.
So you now are the
Sorry,
stealer.
Luke Y. Thompson. Oh, I didn't mean to be a stealer.
No,
I just was thinking.
You did it anyway.
I woke up thinking that was in my brain and my brain alone.
Luke Y. Thompson gave
that's
me
right.
that.
That's right. Sorry, LYT. So
you'll be reading that in my eventual article that's coming up soon about 3D. That yes, we're the only ones who have no choice. Like everybody else, when the movie opens, they can go to a 2D theater, they can go to a 3D theater. Movie critics are SOL, 3D or the bush. So liked it. Liked it a lot. Now, however, speaking of lazy sequels that don't do anything to expand on
Should
the first
Should we do
movie.
Our DVD recommendations first? And here's why I'm asking this question.
Why is that?
Because we're going to have to spoil a lot of things when we talk about The Hangover 2. And we should give people an out. That should be the last thing we talk about.
All right, we'll end with that.
Okay. I think we should talk about that last because we do need to talk about some things that happened in that movie.
Okay.
And if you people haven't seen it, then we will tell you when to stop listening.
Yes. All right. Well, before we get the DVD recommendations, Labor of Love.
Oh, Labor of Love at CineFamily on Friday night. And for those of you who don't know what that is, CineFamily is a theater here in Los Angeles where every night of the week pretty much is something new and unusual and cool and often little seen.
Yeah.
They are a repertory theater that they go out of their way. They dig deep to find like really, really distinctive, unusual stuff for you to watch.
They do what they call vertical programming. So like on a calendar month, every Wednesday night will be silent movies. And then like every Friday late night will be, you know, some series of, you know, crazy sequels or, you know, kung fu movies or whatever. And then every, you know, Sunday afternoon will be whatever. Like they have series that run week to week.
Right.
And then they also do special programs like the one that we saw Friday, which was
a 1976 documentary about the making of this inept art film.
Now, what happened was these people that were making a regular drama, and then
it was meant to be sort of an arty drama, and it was called The Last Affair.
Yeah, it was not necessarily arty. It was just basically a straightforward drama. But then the producers decided that they wanted it to be a porn movie, and because it was the mid-70s, the cast and crew were like, "Okay,
yeah, we'll do this." So now you have to keep in mind, and even I was too young to really grasp this in the 70s.
Yeah, there was that window of legitimacy for porn.
Yeah. Like Deep Throat.
Played first run theaters.
Played in real movie theaters.
And couples went.
And people went to see it.
And they talked about it on TV.
And it was always, I knew what, here's the thing. I was a child and knew that there was a movie out there called Deep Throat.
Right. Now, I would see the ads in the paper.
A child, you know, these days, a seven-year-old would not be.
Could see the movie online, probably.
But in general, if they have, you know, concerned and
attentive
parents, a seven-year-old is not going to know that there's a movie out there called, you know, Gangbang, you know.
Seven.
Gangbang MILFs, or, you know what I mean? Like,
right,
it's,
right.
It's, it doesn't, that's not going to enter into that kid's head. But when we were kids,
this
you could
was,
open up the newspaper.
In the mainstream pop culture.
Yeah, you could open up the newspaper and see the ad for Deep Throat at the movie theater that was happening in your town. And so there was this moment in the culture where not only was porn part of the mainstream, and, you know, like Johnny Carson would talk about it. And who knows, was Linda Lovelace on the talk
probably,
shows?
Probably went on like Merv.
That was the woman
whatever,
who was in Deep Throat, and it made her a star of sorts.
Yeah.
The thing was, is that also the 70s was the time when like the sexual revolution that began in the late 60s was finally sort of trickling down into the suburbs. And so regular folks were all just like, you know, deciding that, okay, well, anything goes, man, and it's all groovy, and let's have key parties and
we're
be swingers.
Because we're on the pill now.
And let's be swingers and have some free love. And and let's be bisexual and all this kind of
let's do
stuff
all the crazy stuff that the college students got to do.
Yeah. Right. And so so for the entire cast and crew to be like, okay, let's do it. Let's make this a porn movie. And the actors, these people who all considered themselves to be legitimate actors, were all like, okay, yeah, I'll take off my clothes and have real sex on camera. You know? So this documentary was a documentary crew followed the making of this movie.
This other camera crew.
And out came this documentary that very few people apparently have seen.
Yeah, it had a theatrical release in the 70s briefly. I mean, like, the trailer they showed had reviews from Siskel and Ebert and, you know, like, folks like that. But then kind of disappeared into obscurity. Some archivist, like, came upon, like, the second reel of it and thought it was great and tracked down the filmmaker, got a copy of the film, and screened it at some documentary festival. And so now it's sort of having a little second life. In fact, if you go to...
It played here in LA. It played at the University of Chicago.
It played in San Francisco.
And in San Francisco.
If you go to www.alaborofloveThemovie.com, there's information about how the film was made and where it's screening next and all that kind of stuff.
Right. And I'm sure that they'll probably make a DVD of it.
I would think so. Yeah. But it's fascinating even in just the movie on movie making kind of genre, because like, this director doesn't really know what he's doing.
No.
Even for like the non-porn movie, he was already at sea. So the fact that it's now a porn movie just makes him even more like baffled. The cast is sort of like half into it and half rationalizing it to themselves. And yeah, it's just at times it almost feels like one of those Christopher Guest movies, because some of the people in it are such twits. the stuff they say is so, you know, just bonkers that it almost felt like one of those kind of, you know, mockumentary deals. But yeah, really, really fascinating film. Definitely one to keep a lookout
for. Yeah, do go try to find that somewhere wherever you are, because it's pretty rad. My DVD recommendation is something that has been out on DVD for a while, but is new to Netflix Instant, which is my new favorite way of watching movies.
Yes.
Because it requires me doing nothing.
Exactly.
The Antonio Banderas, Angelina Jolie movie, Original Sin, is available to now be seen.
And it also just came out on Blu-ray.
On Netflix Instant. I gotta say that I don't remember what this movie is about, but I remember seeing it and thinking it was one of the great bad movies of 2001.
It's a Stephen Ribello favorite.
It is a heaving, bosomy, wet-lipped, you know, erotic something or other. Yeah, and it's the dumbest. Like, you know how when people are really trying hard to be sexy, and it's just funny, and not only is it not sexy, but it's hilarious, and then it turns like
embarrassing,
weird, and embarrassing. That's this movie.
Okay,
and it's pretty awesome. And so, if you have Netflix and you have a Netflix Instant, you could be turning off this podcast right now.
Well,
and begin, and you could start watching Original Sin, which I recommend.
Turn off the podcast right now. Stop it
and go watch Original Sin. Yet, Alonzo's DVD recommendation doesn't matter, and neither does either of our opinions of Hangover 2.
But there's so many other things that we'll be talking about, so don't listen to Dave White. You can watch it when we're done. My DVD pick this week is the documentary Public Speaking, which is directed by Martin Scorsese, and it's about Fran Lebowitz, who has basically made a career out of not writing her third book. She wrote two very well-received books of essays, Metropolitan
Life. In the 70s.
Yeah,
both really funny.
Metropolitan Life
and
Social
right
Studies.
Behind me.
Well, I see Social Studies.
On the
bookshelf,
they are
Metropolitan
right
Life?
Right here.
Oh, so we do. Yeah, we have both of them. Yeah, she was an editor at Interview Magazine, and then wrote these very, very funny kind of, you know, short pieces, observations.
She did write something a couple years ago.
Yeah.
She wrote the foreword.
Oh, that's right. To that new edition of...
Butterfield 8, right. Yes.
But generally speaking, this is a woman who is witty and very funny and very acerbic and gets a lot of money.
Mean.
Yeah.
She's mean.
And she gets a lot of money for giving lectures and answering questions. But has made a fortune on books that she will probably never write at this point.
Right.
She's one of the great procrastinators and writer's block havers of all time.
But people pay her now just to hear her. Just to hear her talk. Just to come. Yeah, she'll go talk to people and then they pay her money.
She is one of the last of the great conversationalists. So anyway, it's a really interesting documentary about her life as her, you know.
She says one of the most outrageous things in this documentary about AIDS.
About how it did to a generation of choreographers and dancers and singers who died of AIDS could come back and see who got famous after the vacuum that they left behind. Yeah, she says you just want to be able to tell them, guess who's famous?
Guess who has a career?
Guess who has a career? You'll never believe it.
She doesn't name names.
No.
But you know who she's talking about. And I can't believe she... part of me... Okay, I laughed when she said that. But another part of me was like, you're the meanest lady alive.
The thing that I liked was where she...
Which talked, is kind of why I like her. Because if you're super mean and you make me laugh and I'm conflicted in my feelings toward you, I'll probably be your fan.
Where she talks about like how grotesque celebrity has gotten and how basically the whole notion of superstar was a joke that Warhol started.
Right.
And like, you know, bestowed the title upon these rather middling drag queens. But then the culture sort of ran with it. And she goes, that's what happens when a private joke goes public.
Right.
People don't get it, you know, and now we have People Magazine. So, before we get to Hangover 2, I just want to do our usual closing stuff. Have not been getting many emails from you folks. Would love to hear what you have to say.
We don't have any listeners.
Well, I like...
That's why there's no mail.
Humor me.
No one's listening
humor
to the
me.
Show.
I like to pretend somebody is. Would love to hear from you with your opinions about the show, your opinions about movies, whatever you got. Linoleum Podcast.
We're doing this for our own enjoyment.
Linoleum Podcast. I just want you to at gmail.com.
Wake up to that cold reality.
Look, just in case this signal, you know, hits some barren civilization somewhere, I want to make sure we're covered. Linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
He's asking you to write him an email and tell him how much you love us.
No,
that's what he wants.
Not necessarily.
That is, in fact, what you want.
I'm not barring that, but if they could be about anything. Lots of people have been adding us at Twitter, so thank you for that, at LinoleumCast at Twitter. And once we get these pictures back from Graham, I will be setting up our Facebook page. I'll be posted about that.
Yes. He had to take them to his laboratory.
To develop them.
His dark room.
To develop them digitally. Want to thank our friends at other podcasts, of course. Gray Drake at the Popcorn Mafia. The Kooky Kids over at Secretly Timid. The Comedy Couch with Dennis.
Are they kids?
Well, compared to us, they are.
How old are they?
They're...
How old are the Timids?
Late 20s, I'm thinking.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I need a...
You met Paul. How old do you say he is?
I think everyone is my age. Well... It doesn't matter. Unless it's like Will. I think everyone is who's 23.
No,
and Graham, who's also 23. Right. I think everyone's my age.
Yeah, no, these guys are younger than us. The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, and Blowhard with Malcolm Ingram. Dave White will be on assignment next week and not here. You're not going
to
be here for next week.
I'm going to Texas.
Yes.
Not an assignment.
I was kidding.
My assignment is go to my mother's nursing home.
Yes.
And watch her feed herself with her new weighted spoon.
It's an assignment.
I'm going to be gone for a week to Texas. So next week,
Ryan Downey is going to happen. Ryan Downey from MTV will be portraying me. He will be here. He listens to the show.
Ryan does listen to the show.
Yes. Like he was actually excited to be coming on this thing.
His wife came to the drive-in with us last Saturday night, as a matter of fact.
That was great.
She's awesome. Did you get a chance to talk to her?
I had never met her before.
I had not met her until that night, and she's lovely.
And she's real pretty.
Wants to talk about concession stands a lot.
Well, then...
She hung around the concession stand with me, and we just talked about carne asada things.
This is a woman who knows how to get Dave White to talk to her.
So, Ryan Downey will step into the role of Dave White
next Sunday. Next episode.
Yeah.
So now we're going to talk about the Hangover Part 2, and we're going to spoil the heck out of this. So if you have not seen Hangover Part 2 yet, which I can't imagine, because apparently The Thing made a gajillion billion dollars this weekend. And you don't want to know what happens in The Hangover Part 2.
That's not really a number.
Stop listening now. Okay, go.
Wait, I can still... people are still listening.
Well, it's their fault. They've been warned. So if they're still listening,
all right, so they want to know. Here's the other thing about talking about this movie is that in order to spoil it, we also have to describe it in a way that allows us to keep our clean.
Oh, that's true.
iTunes rating.
But we are writers. We can do this. We am good vocabulary.
Well, first of all, it is exactly the same movie as Hangover Part 1. And I mean,
like, down to the beats.
The jokes, the everything. They trade
Vegas for Bangkok.
Vegas for Bangkok. A tiger for a monkey.
Or the monkey for the baby, depending on how you look at it.
The monkey for the baby.
Ed Helms' tooth for Ed Helms' new face tattoo.
Right.
Justin Barta is still left out of the most of the action.
Correct.
Ken Jeong is there
presence
again.
Is beefed up a little bit.
Yeah, but it's, as somebody did on Twitter last night, here's my impersonation of Ken Jeong. Ha 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 ha, bitches! but he's actually pretty funny.
He's really funny in the movie. And here's the thing. I was given a very nice compliment this week.
Really?
By a friend of ours who writes for the New York Times.
Ew.
So this is not...
Ew.
So this is not just any old person complimenting me. This is a person who knows great, brilliant, intelligent writing when she sees it.
Is this the person who got mad at Jack Valenti?
And I don't know. And No, it was not.
Oh, different. New
it
York
was
Times
not. It was a different person.
Okay.
And this person said that my line in my review of Hangover Part 2 at movies.com was really great, in which I compared it to eating Lucky Charms for dinner two nights in a row out of a bowl that you haven't washed.
That sure was a joke you made.
That was.
Remember that joke?
You know what? That was a line that I was told was really great, and I was praised for it. And it made me very happy to be praised for it. And now I'm bragging about being praised for it.
You're the worst person ever. Actually, that's not true. The worst person ever is the characters in The Hangover Part 2.
That's actually true. Yeah. Because this
movie is so, basically, both of these films boil down to being about heterosexual white male privilege. It's that, we can do what we want, woo, you know. And
I was going to get to that, but first I would like to say that I laughed from beginning to end, just like I did in the first movie. Yes. I laughed from start to finish.
I
thought the first one was funny, and I thought this one was funny, and I will not apologize.
I may have laughed a little more in this one than I did in the first one, but I didn't laugh much in either.
I think these movies are stupidly fun. And if you're
half right.
If you don't think past the surface, then you are doing exactly what the movie wants you to do, and you are going to have a good time. You will laugh. However,
you might.
Getting into what you were about to say about white heterosexual male privilege, as people who listen to this podcast know, or maybe they don't know, we are both the gays.
Yes.
And but that's not something that I ever really care so much about, like, infusing into my perspective while I'm watching movies. But here it's a thing, and here's why. Gay dudes know that their actions in the world are going to have consequences. Even the actions that un-gay dudes would
get away with.
Not just get away with, but consider innocuous.
Right.
You know, if two gay guys are in a relationship and they want to hold hands or kiss each other in public, there could very well be consequences to that decision.
A riot could break out.
Yeah, something could happen to you. You know, I mean, like, depending on where you are, where you live,
right?
You know,
what country you're in.
Yeah, how mean you come across, you know, in terms of like people wanting to mess with you, you know,
or for that matter, how you know, if you come off as effeminate or whatever,
correct,
and you're, you know, there are correct people out there who will, so, let you know they don't approve of that sort of thing.
Basically, everyone in the world, not just gays, but everyone in the world who is not, you know, in a position of total power,
right, is cognizant.
Is cognizant of the fact that sometimes things they do that other people take for granted are going to have consequences. And they might have negative consequences. You know, like if a woman smoked in 1915, her husband might take her home and spank her for it. You know what I mean? Like that kind of thing.
Is that a Virginia Sims?
Yeah. And so, so here's the thing. These movies... And I'm not going to say that straight guys don't understand that their actions have consequences, because I have lots of straight male friends and they all understand that the world works in a certain way. And if you do bad things, then your actions will have consequences. If you are caught, generally, you're going to get in trouble or something bad could happen to you. If you are destroying everything you touch, if you are actively self-destructive, then something as a consequence will befall you.
Yeah. Now, but usually, these movies, by the time you've graduated from college or like
it usually takes being into your early to mid 20s.
Usually, yeah, it will have sunk in by then. Once you've stopped being an active member of a fraternity,
right,
you know, it might occur to you that, you know, there's a social contract that you aren't supposed to be violating.
But these movies operate in a fantasy universe where absolutely nothing bad happens to the guys who are wreaking havoc everywhere they go, destroying things, having things set on fire, blown up.
Starting fights,
crashing cars, getting involved in, like, crimes.
Yeah, stealing animals and people.
Yeah, stealing animals, kidnapping people, dumping them into, like, you know, ice machines, you know, like... And then there's this other thing that has now become a two-time thing in these movies.
Oh, right.
In the first movie, Ed Helms, his mouth full of blood.
Yanks out one of his own canines, and then...
His mouth full of blood kisses a prostitute with tongue. This is open mouth, bloody mouth kissing, all right? And you're thinking to yourself while you're watching it, had you ought to be kissing A, anyone, or B, a prostitute with your bleeding
exposed
mouth
gums.
Now here's what happens in part two.
Spoiler.
Here comes the big spoiler of part two. In the middle of this movie, Ed Helms learns that he has had sex with another prostitute. But this prostitute is a transgendered woman. Boobs,
what they call,
and a penis.
What they call a ladyboy in Thailand.
In Thailand, stripper bar, prostitute, you know, slang.
Yes.
This person is a ladyboy. Played in the movie by a woman named Yasmin Lee, who is a trans porn star. She's been in dozens of trans porn videos. You can go to her page on IMDb and read the titles of these videos that she has been in. They all have titles that I cannot say if we want to keep our clean
rating, yes,
rating on iTunes. But her name is Yasmin Lee, Yasmin Lee. She's in the movie, and he discovers that he has had sex with her.
She breaks the news.
She breaks the news to him and says, oh yes, I did this thing to you from behind.
Ed Helms was the receptive partner,
yes,
of their coupling.
He bottoms for her.
Yes. And apparently enjoyed it.
And enjoyed it, and it was unprotected.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so that's as naughty as we need to describe, yes, what happens. But so here's the thing. The movie completely pretends like, oh, it's okay. Just Bradley Cooper's character actually says to him, this is a line from the movie, forget about it. It doesn't matter. And I'm thinking to myself, does he get a test positive for HIV in The Hangover Part 3?
Post-exposure prophylaxics mean nothing to these people?
Because, again, in this fantasy universe...
If you've had unprotected receptive sex with a prostitute...
Or anyone.
Yeah, especially, though, a prostitute. Probably not a bad idea to maybe, like, do the morning after HIV drugs. Right. Just saying.
Just, so, but again, these movies exist in a fantasy world where there are no consequences. So, no, nothing bad is going to happen to Ed Helms.
No.
The movie, it treats everything as weighing the same. So, like, hey, some guy cut off his finger. Hey, that monkey smoking cigarettes. Hey, we're involved in a drug deal. Hey, this prostitute just did this thing to you. And you liked it. And there was no, and you, no, all we have to do is get back to the wedding on time. It also operates in a fantasy world where every woman they encounter is utterly
forgiving,
compliant and forgiving. They might be a little cranky on the phone.
Right.
With them, but never to their face. Once they get there, it's fine. I don't care what you did. I'm just happy that you're here with me.
Smooch, smooch.
Let's kiss and forget about it all.
But,
and I think that's really weird. Yeah. Like, I think these movies have this other whole, like, thing going on where it is, it's science fiction for people.
For straight guys.
Yeah. Where you can just do whatever you want.
But I want to point out real quick, because both Dave and I this week, I did a piece for After Elton, you did a piece for Queerty, where we talked about how the inclusion of...
Now, this is another issue.
Yes.
Yes.
The inclusion of the transgender prostitute and how she is portrayed in the film actually feels like a step forward.
Right.
Because nobody freaks out about it, nobody, like, vomits, nobody beats her up. They just sort of like, ha-ha, it's this other thing that happened, and
he doesn't go off and have and give himself his own silkwood shower or anything like
none
that.
None of that stuff, you know? Yeah. And so I think in a comedy that is for the most part, you know, appealing to sort of the most Cro-Magnon of straight guys, that feels like progress to me. That, I think, is what progress looks like. But for a lot of people, because the scene exists at all, because there's a line where Ed Helms says, I had sex with a man with boobies, then everybody's like, oh, it's transphobic. Well, and I think that's a really simplistic kind of knee-jerk response to comedy, frankly, which is supposed to be, you know,
I understand people
ruffling
being,
feathers.
I understand people being upset by the language that is used to describe this woman.
Sure. But it's context and who's saying it.
However, her character is the one who calls the shots.
Totally.
Her character is totally in control of the situation. Her character is the one that's mocking him, in fact, for
being such a wuss about it the next day.
For being such a baby about it the next day. And the movie is mocking him for being such a wuss about it. The movie is like, ha, 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 look what happened to you, you know? And so in that context, in the context of raunchy comedy, it is a weirdly positive thing because, like I said in this piece that I wrote for Queerty, Queerty.com. There are movies like Boys Don't Cry that make people sad and raise awareness that bad things do, in fact, happen to trans people all the time.
The trans people exist, frankly.
All the time, every day, you know, horrible things.
Right.
One recently just beaten by a mob in a McDonald's in what city? What? Some American town. Yeah. But there are lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of people. Most people are not going to ever watch Boys Don't Cry. But everybody's going to see Hangover 2. And visibility and a normalization of whatever kind of person you happen to be. I know some people, the Queerty comments are running toward the angle of, well, we hate it that she's portrayed as a prostitute. And we hate it that they cast an actual porn star in the role, and we hate the kind of trans person she is.
Right, but the role requires full frontal nudity, and in fact, I think the use of the full frontal nudity, again, there's a certain shock value to it, but I think also it's how you get people to start getting comfortable with the concept.
Yes, again, you know,
visibility
works,
comedy, unapologetic, in-your-face kind of stuff.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, this is a crap movie. I'm not defending it at all. But I think that for trans
people... Oh, it's a funny movie.
I think for trans people, it represents a step forward. You may have your own opinions. Let us know at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Okay, are we done? Are we good?
You're done, and I'm good.
One last thing. I forgot to mention, we were talking about other podcasts. The guys at Criterion Cast, our conversation continued into what they call the Disc 2 episode. So if you go to CriterionCast.com, click on the on under podcasts on Disc 2, you'll see where we talk about other new movies and new DVDs. And I basically try to break them of the using Electric Boogaloo as the default joke for sequels. So we came up with a lot of other...
You're paddling up against the tide. Well,
we came up with a lot of
Electric Boogaloo is the go-to thing for everybody.
I know. But we came up with a lot of other
Boring.
We came up with a lot of other...
Sorry, guys at Criterion Cast.
No, they were they agreed with me. And so we came up with a lot of other fun, like, part two.
I mean, they're not the only offenders. And
No. Everybody does.
And you probably did break them of it, I guess. But, yeah.
So now hopefully... They'll go to you know, the Legend of Curly's Gold or something else. So, All right, that is our show. Thank you for tuning in this week, and we'll catch you next time.
Well, you'll catch
him. Catch you next time. Dave will be.
I will be Ryan Downey next week.
Yes, but Ryan Downey will join us. So tune in for that. It should be fun. Bye.